This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Carol Crist. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm delighted to welcome you here for what I think is going to be an excellent, excellent talk. It's by Patricia Pelfrey. She's known to many of you. She's a senior associate, research associate at the center, but I wanted to begin this introduction by headlining that she's a scholar of English literature. And she has her PhD in English from our own department at Berkeley. And she just recently finished her dissertation on a little bit more than a year ago on in the field of English Romanticism, specifically on conceptions of knowledge in English Romanticism. Now, if it weren't the current context in news around the University of California, I would say that the other part of her career is not quite as romantic as that. She has worked as on the senior staff of five UC presidents: Charles Hitch, David Saxon, David Gardner, Jack Peltison, and Richard Atkinson. And that gives her just an extraordinary perspective about the history of the University of California from the top. She has authored or co-authored papers on affirmative action, undergraduate admissions, and industry-university relationships, which gives you a sense of the critical issues that she was involved with in her time at the University of California. She is the co-author with Margaret Cheney of A Brief History of the University of California, published by UC Press in 2004, editor of The Pursuit of Knowledge, Speeches and Papers of Richard Atkinson, which was published again by UC Press in 2007. Her most recent book is Entrepreneurial President Richard Atkinson in the University of California, again, UC Press 2012. So she's going to talk to us today about the one university and its future, and I'm sure we're all eager to hear her talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. And thank you very much for mentioning my PhD, which was quite an experience. I should mention that I started in graduate school here at the University of California at Berkeley in 1964. I left for my many years in the Office of the President in 1970. I came back and finished my PhD in the fall of 2014. So there is such a thing as the 50-year PhD. And when I told a friend of mine who is here about that I had finally finished, he just looked at me and he said, "Has the English department figured out yet just what you've done to their time to degree statistics?" So anyway, I'd like to start off by talking briefly about why I became interested in this subject. The one reason is obviously that I spent 32 years in the Office of the President, where the one university idea is very popular. And as time went by, and when I came over to the Berkeley campus to do research and writing at the Center for Studies in Higher Education, after all those years in the Office of the President, I had a chance to look at the University of California from the campus perspective, and I realized how different those two views of the world were. So that was one thing. I was interested in looking at it from both sides. Another thing is that in recent years, as I'm sure many of you know, there have been a spate of books, articles, and papers talking about how higher education in the United States needs to be remade from the inside out, that we need to change the DNA. This is a special problem, perhaps, for research universities like the University of California, because the money crunch is having major impacts on the ability of these universities to do the kind of work they need to do. So this got me thinking about the whole topic of university organization. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk a little bit about the origins and evolution of the one university idea in the University of California. It's not a new idea, it's an old idea. It dates to the 1930s. And then I'm going to talk about its status today. So it's been around for 75, 80 years. That is a long time for a particular cultural ethos to be a real force in university administration, yet I'm going to argue that it really has been. And then I'm going to, after I've looked at its status today and where it is, I'm going to talk a bit about models of university governance and in terms of the one university idea. And one of the spin-offs of this whole discussion of universities and how they're governed is the question of multi-campus systems. And of course, UC was the first multi-campus system in the United States. Multi-campus systems have become a target in recent years. They are seen as too bureaucratic, too large, too unwieldy, inadequate to the problems of financing the academic enterprise. So one of the things I'm going to argue is that not only is the University of California in good shape in terms of governance, but that the one university idea is a good framework for its future as well. Finally, in the course of discussing it, I will be talking about what I'm calling economic models of governance. And when I say that, use that term, I am not implying that economic models of governance are inattentive to academic issues. They are. I call them that because they are specifically designed to deal with the fiscal and financial problems that higher education faces, and several of them have been proposed by former chancellors here at UC. I won't have time to get into the specifics, but they do track some of the criticisms being made of multi-campus systems in the country generally. So I'll be able to, in talking about the economic model generally, I'll be including some of the UC models. Okay, but first, let's start with the one university idea. What is it? Well, just to give you a preview, it defines the relationships within the university in the following terms. The president of the University of California is the chief campus officer or chief executive officer of the entire university. It has a system of campuses in which the chancellors are the chief executive officers. There's an academic senate that consists of a statewide body and campus divisions. This is fairly unusual among multi-campus systems. So it's one of a number of ways in which UC is different. We have had a tradition of uniform standards for undergraduate admissions and fees, the same high standards for academic programs, faculty recruitment, and review. That is, the same expectation that all campus will strive for high academic quality in that. A single state budget, this has been very important over the years, allocated to the campuses by the president. And a tradition of authority, if I could sum it up, it would be a tradition of authority at the center combined with an institutional preference for decentralization. The story begins with two presidents. First is Robert Gordon Sproul. He was president from 1930 to 1958. No one before him had served as president for 28 years. No one after him has served for president that long. I predict no one will. Having served five presidents, no chance. Okay, in the 1930s, the context had to do with the growth of demand for higher education in California. Robert Gordon Sproul had several things he was very concerned about. One was the state colleges, now the California State University. He saw them as a threat to UC. They were a competing public system. He felt there should be one primary public system, and that, of course, ought to be the land-grant institution, the University of California. So he was worried about maintaining the University of California against encroachments on its turf, so to speak, by the state colleges. But he had another problem, and that was a north-south problem. UCLA had the southern branch for many years, had made UC the first multi-campus system when it became a campus in 1919. And Southern California was growing exponentially, and there was a lot of pressure in Southern California for making Los Angeles a campus with an equal status of Berkeley. There were a lot of controls exercised from Berkeley on the Los Angeles campus, and so Sproul had that problem as well. So his worry was that UCLA would split off from the university community. He was very worried about that, and he determined to prevent it. So what he began to do was to argue that the University of California, despite its size and its diversity, could only be considered as a single university. And if you were to split off any campus, Los Angeles or any other campus, from the university, you would damage the integrity of the whole institution. That was a very successful political strategy, but he also saw it, that was externally. Internally, he saw it as a strategy for centralization, and so he is known as the centralizing president. He hung on to central authority over campuses for many years, in spite of the fact that the university itself was growing, and that as the 1960s approached, remember, he was president until 1958, Tidal Wave One was about to hit the baby boomers, and the university was going to have to grow and add three new campuses. His grasp of detail was quite impressive, but it was administratively sclerotic. There are many examples, and they are fun to read. One of them, I was browsing through a protocol manual that dates to the 1930s, and one of the requirements in the protocol manual was that no one could pick any flowers on the Berkeley campus for a campus event without getting permission from the office of the president. So one other example, the last budget that he submitted to the regents for transmittal to the legislature in his last year as president ran to 1,100 pages, and it had an appendix that contained the names and salaries of every single University of California employee. He was against decentralization, and I'll talk a little bit more about this at the end, but he was against even having chancellors at all, because he was afraid that if you disperse power around the university, you were going to threaten the one university idea, which was very important to him. However, when Clark Kerr became president, he was president from 1958 to 1966. He had been Berkeley's first chancellor. He'd been chancellor under Sproul. He had very little to do. That's also one of the most enjoyable or amusing parts of his memoir, to read what he had to do to fill up his time when he was chancellor at Berkeley. So when he came, he had seen close up what Sproul's kind of management meant for the University of California. And so he had a whole new blueprint for the University of California. And his first order of business was massive delegations of responsibility, first of all from the regents to the president, and then from the president to the chancellors. This was going to be a reorganization to meet the demands of growth, in which it was obvious that the University of California was much too big to be run from any central office. So Sproul had wedded the one university idea to centralization. Kerr divorced them. But he didn't give up the one university idea. In fact, in announcing his reorganization, which, by the way, went on over the course of 8 years and covered many aspects of the university, not just the kind of delegations I'm talking about, but when he made his announcement of his reorganization, and he said, in my administration, the burden of proof will rest with the centralizers. But he also said, there will continue to be one University of California as provided in the Constitution of the State of California. I think that is maybe a little debatable. I don't think that in 1868 people were thinking, oh, maybe this is going to become a multi-campus system. But in any event, this was something that he wanted to combine the two. Obviously, there's a certain tension between authority at the center and independence on the campuses. And Kerr recognized that this entailed its own problems. But what he wanted to do, and he was very explicit about this, was to create a federation of campuses, not a centralized state, which is what he felt that Sproul had done, not a weak confederation, but this combination of authority at the center, independence at the campuses. And he recognized that there was more potential for conflict, but that the one university organization, which had authority vested at different levels, system-wide, campus, academic, administrative, allowed a lot of room for negotiation, discussion, and compromise. And one thing about the University of California is that, as Jack Peldison used to say, it takes a lot of talking to run the University of California. He also said he'd never worked in any organization where more people wanted to be told first. Okay, so I'm really going back to the first slide. What the Kerr Revolution accomplished was university-wide structures and practices. I'm just reminding us, the Academic Senate, uniform standards of quality across the campuses, a single state budget allocated to the campuses by the president, and all campuses share the aspiration to attain the level of quality set by Berkeley and UCLA. And what this said, in essence, was that not all campuses were at the same level of quality, the same level of development, the same level of anything, but they were equal in their right to attain, within the limits of what the university was able to do, the status of a great university, which Berkeley was acknowledged to be very early on. David Saxon, who was president from 1975 to 1983, he called this last characteristic, that all the campuses share the same aspirations, he called it endemic excellence. And he said this was not merely a rhetorical statement or a rarefied ideal. In fact, he said the one university principle was an operational principle, seriously intended and scrupulously applied. And this is the way he put it, and I think it's, I will read it. I think it's worth reading. And he explained it this way. He said, Berkeley provided the initial inspiration for the other campuses. It set the norm, defined the standards, acted as a monitor, and served as a challenge. Berkeley faculty and staff furnished expert assistance to the newer campuses. Berkeley demonstrated that absolute academic distinction actually could be achieved at a public university. And he says, when I came to the Los Angeles campus in 1947 as a faculty member, it was because I was confident that ultimately the Berkeley heritage would assure a similar level of quality at UCLA. Now, I have to say, David Saxon had perhaps a unique approach to job hunting, to look into the philosophy of an entire system before deciding to take a job in a physics department at one campus. But if you knew David Saxon, you would understand that is the way it was. Well, so that all sounds wonderful, right? But there were tensions in the one university idea. The tensions between North and South. Sproul once said that one of his biggest problems in running the university was dealing with the tensions between Berkeley and UCLA. Berkeley always, for many years, saw UCLA as the younger sister. UCLA thought Berkeley hogged all the resources of the university and that it was trying to sit on its younger sibling and keep it from thriving. And in fact, there was, this was Sproul, but Kerr, who was a liberator of chancellors, ran into some of the same problems, and there were a number of them, but let me just mention one very telling example. In 1965, when student unrest was really getting going in the University of California, the Regents commissioned a report on the causes and answers to student unrest. And they employed an attorney in Los Angeles named Jerome Byrne. When Jerome Byrne turned in his report, it turned out to be about governance. And what he said was, the University of California is organized all wrong, basically. All the campuses should be chartered as independent universities. They should report directly to the Board of Regents, raising the question of, okay, what do you do with the president? Byrne had an answer. He said the president should serve as chairman of the Board of Regents. What the chairman of the Board of Regents does is preside over meetings. So essentially, this was writing the president out of the script. The Regents Committee did not accept the recommendations of this report, but Kerr always thought, and he said he had good reason to think that the although it was written by a Los Angeles attorney, the impetus had come from the chancellor at UCLA. All right. So much for history. The one university idea today. 50 years on from the successes and the discords of the Kerr Revolution, what can we say about the status of the one university idea? Well, first of all, it continues to be a cultural ethos within the University of California. And it's this cultural dimension, it's the pervasive emphasis on quality, the UC legacy of quality that every new campus, including UC Merced, has inherited, that has had the deepest and most lasting effects. It is a dramatic departure from the practice of most multi-campus systems, which have typically protected their flagship campus from competition. And some years ago, when Hugh Davis Graham and Nancy Diamond published a study of the rise of the American Research University and evaluated different systems of governance, they were particularly impressed by the University of California, which at that time had 6 members of the Association of American Universities among its campuses, with one campus that is strictly for the health sciences. And what they said was, the University of California showed a surprisingly consistent academic quality throughout, and that the speed with which some of the smaller campuses, and they specified Santa Barbara, Riverside, and Santa Cruz, was astonishing. And they attributed UC's success to 2 things. One was the master plan for higher education, and the second was the one university idea. What about the one university idea as a political strategy? Well, that continues to, I think, work for the university. It helps to have one voice in Sacramento. You may have noticed when the state audit came out on out-of-state enrollment that it was the president who made a response. I think that probably is good for the campuses. It helps to have one voice rather than a number of them. And on this campus, Mike Heyman, who was chancellor here in the 1980s, I heard him at a talk not long before he died. And the question was raised at this talk, would the campuses of the university be better off as separate individual campuses? And Heyman's response was that to be a chancellor is to seek independence. But if Berkeley had been part of a system in the 1960s, it would have been decimated. I think that's true, and I'm impressed that a Berkeley chancellor said that, even more so. UC's presence as 10 campuses across the state increases its political influence. So as a system, this is obvious, but I think it bears repeating. As a system, it has more political influence than it would as 10 separate campuses. And finally, I think this is the weight and influence of the University of California as a system is a really important shield for its constitutional autonomy. Very few public universities have this, a handful of states. It's been essential to UC's climb to one of the preeminent universities in the world, and it's very important. Well, one thing that has changed a lot is the symbolic role of the president. It has waned. The high tide of the president's symbolic role was with Robert Gordon Sproul. He was a dramatic person himself. It is said that he could whisper and would carry 100 yards. Makes him sound like an alarming person to have at a dinner party. But in any event, he was very extroverted. He was charismatic, and he used it to the hilt to argue, as I've said, internally and externally for the unity of the university. In fact, at one point, they tried to lure him back to Columbia University. He went to the Regents, and he said, I have 2 questions for you before I make a decision. 1, do you want me to stay? 2, will you protect the unity of the University of California? The Regents said yes to both, and they added, the unity of the university shall be sacred. So Sproul stayed. One of the things he did that has been most famous, many of you probably know this, is that at the annual football game between Berkeley and UCLA, at halftime, to show his lack of favoritism, he would do a ceremonial march across the field. I don't know whether he was imitating Theodore Roosevelt, who was the first. Theodore Roosevelt was the first person to do that at the Army-Navy game. But Sproul had a flair for the dramatic. Well, all that has changed over time. A lot of university-wide events, some of you will remember the All-University Faculty Conference. There were UC-wide clubs for students. And there was the All-University Charter Day that was celebrated here at Berkeley with delegations from all the campuses. The last university-wide Charter Day was in 1985. It is now a Berkeley campus celebration, not a university-wide. And I think the most, what makes the point most clearly is that there are still public inaugurations for chancellors. There has been no public inauguration for a UC president in more than 20 years. So that's a big change. Now, budget allocation. I mentioned that the practice had been for the president to and the office of the president to allocate the budgets to the campuses. And, of course, there were always formulas. And, I mean, it wasn't done from the base from the beginning every year. But nonetheless, there was wide presidential discretion over the allocation of budgets. In March 2011, there were several changes initiated. One was the funding streams proposal, in which the campuses keep certain revenue they generate, non-resident tuition, patent revenue, indirect costs related to research, for example. That just goes straight through to the campuses. And a second one is called rebenching, and it distributes state funds on a weighted formula intended to create more equal funding per student on each campus. This came from two sources. One is that the state commented that the smaller campuses that enrolled more low-income and minority students were not getting the same amount per student as some of the other campuses, and it was also pushed for within the university by smaller campuses. The argument back is that different students cost different amounts to educate and train. It costs more to educate and train a student at a medical center than it does in a liberal arts class. But in any event, these changes were adopted, and their intent is to give campuses in a time of budgetary stress, to give them more flexibility, more predictability about their funding, and to increase the transparency of the budget process. But at the same time, I think there can be no doubt that they have circumscribed the president's historical ability to provide startup funds for new initiatives like the California Digital Library, the Humanities Research Institute in the 1980s, and to push system-wide priorities through the budget, and potentially to fund new campuses. So that is probably the biggest departure from the One University idea. Nonetheless, I think we can say overall that the really important part, the cultural ethos, is still there. There's a lot going on that reflects the One University idea, so I think we can say it's alive and well today. However, now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the larger issue of multi-campus organization. And Ames McGinnis, who is an expert on multi-campus universities in the United States, has talked about three different reasons that since 2008 and the Great Recession, which really brought home to everyone the long-term financial problems of universities, since that time, there are three reasons for discontent in multi-campus universities. One is that the Board of Trustees, Board of Regents in our case, is too far away from the campuses, doesn't understand their problems. This is, again, to a great extent, a problem for flagship universities, which really feel threatened. Number two is that if the state is going to withdraw its money, then it really ought to withdraw its oversight and controls. All the reports that the universities have to file, limits on construction, various kinds of regulation that they find costly and burdensome. Third is a more fundamental kind of criticism, which is that systems thwart local campus initiative and entrepreneurial strategies and prevent them from doing things that they would like to do in order to preserve quality. I call the proposals that are directed at dealing specifically with the financial problems of multi-campus systems and universities, which are what are really coming along now. I call them the economic model, and I don't mean to suggest that, again, that academic values aren't important to people who propose these models, just that financial concerns are really primary in them. There have been a number of reforms for UC, three of them by former chancellors, two Berkeley chancellors, Chancellors Bergeneau and Birdall. Chancellor Bergeneau was co-authored with other people here on the campus. And, I mean, yes, and Chancellor Young at UCLA. I can't talk about them in particular, but they reflect in one way or another these three objections to system organization, and they try to deal with that in different ways. Now I'd like to talk about what I'm calling the economic model that is primarily devoted to dealing with financial problems of universities in terms of the one university model, because it seems to me that there are some things that they leave out. And one of them is that the president tends to disappear in these models. It's just like in the Barron Report. It's kind of a natural outcome of an emphasis on local control. The president becomes less important. The chancellor, local officials become more important. And as the Barron Report implicitly recognized, the president is pivotal in the university system. Why is that? Well, first of all, the president sets the agenda for the board's discussion of UC and its future. Now, he does it. He makes recommendations to the board. Typically, this is done with broad consultation with chancellors, laboratory directors, various members of the university community. And a recommendation usually reflects some kind of consensus among these groups, and very much so including the Academic Senate as well. Typically, but it doesn't have to. In the UC system, the president is the chief executive officer. If he disagrees with the sense of the community, he can recommend what he wants to the board. And it is primarily through this role that the president sets the direction of the system, plans for its future, and it's the primary reason that the Board of Regents discussions become more than serial conversations about specific campus problems. It really embodies the idea that UC is one university and that its problems must be dealt with that way. Well, presidential leadership, I'm arguing, is the way that UC has reconciled what seemed to be two contradictory impulses in its traditions. That is, strong authority at the center combined with maximum campus independence. As former President David Gardner put it, the University of California president is the one officer who is accountable for the totality of the university's endeavors. And when Jack Peldison was president, at one point a UC regent, Ward Connerly, wrote a letter to the entire board, and in which he made the remark that the administration tries to convince us to do what they think is right, but the administration is just one constituency among others. Peldison wrote a letter back, and he said, very politely, I'm afraid this is wrong. The university is not a democracy. It is not a court of law. The president is the publicly designated agent of the regents, and in concert with the faculty and the chancellors, he makes recommendations to the regents. The regents may, and sometimes do, reject his recommendations. And if they reject his recommendations, too often the president ought to resign. But basically, the president's recommendation have a weight, or ought to be given a weight, beyond that of just any constituent of the university. Well, also, I think it is also clear that a weak president does not serve the university well. I don't think he serves the university well internally, but certainly not externally. Historically, the UC president has exercised a great deal of influence in the arena of California higher education. Just think about Clark Kerr during the master plan. It was a time in which there was a lot of flux in higher education. There was a lot of uncertainty over how enrollments were going to be apportioned among the University of California. The California State University and the community colleges, and it was Kerr's leadership that brought about the master plan. In fact, it's said that the regents chose him because he had been a labor negotiator, he had great negotiating skills, and he certainly proved that during the master plan. I think right now we are in another state, another period in which there's a lot of flux and uncertainty in higher education right now. You know, people are concerned about the master plan, whether that is really holding up in the absence of state funding. The California Post-Secondary Education Commission was disbanded, I think, back in 2011. And so we need the president of the University of California to be a strong voice in what are probably going to be another round of negotiations about accommodating enrollment, whether California will grow or not grow in terms of student enrollment in the coming years. It's predicted that the state will probably reach a population of 60 million by 2050, kind of a terrifying thought. And so there needs to be a conversation about higher education in this state. I think inevitably there will be. And the University of California president needs very much to be a part of that conversation. Okay. A second assumption of many economic models is that system-wide structures are somehow inimical to campus interests, or even the campus interests are so different they can't be reconciled. In the first place, all campuses benefit from collective strategies and centralized solutions. I've mentioned some of them, One Voice in Sacramento. But in addition, there are also advantages to system organization. One is, in the University of California, the office of the president houses the office of the general counsel. It means that every campus doesn't need to hire its own environmental lawyer, although each campus does have an attorney, which reports through the office of the general counsel. Collective bargaining is done centrally, and that also allows the university to work out a single position, and so each campus isn't doing its own negotiation and collective bargaining. UCOP manages the retirement system. Benefits are the same across all campuses. And finally, one of the perhaps less well-known advantages of being part of a system is that the credit rating for the University of California system is much better than any particular campus. And UC has just financed its second 100-year bond. I didn't know there was such a thing as a 100-year bond. But it allows you to borrow funds at the historically low rates that are prevalent today, and you have until 2116 to pay it back. And so presumably inflation takes care of a lot of the costs. Others consider that controversial. But in any event, there really are advantages to centralization, which I think are often not considered. Finally, I want to talk on this subject. I want to talk just briefly about the Office of the President. And I must say at the outset, this may be what I'm going to say may be just a function of where I come from. I may be overly sensitive to some of the things going on. But it seems to me that in discussions I hear about the role of the Office of the President these days, there's a lot of emphasis on UCOP as a source of services. And along with that goes the idea that campuses ought to be able to pay for just the services they use and not the services they don't. And I mentioned in connection with this, a couple of years ago, a chancellor of a campus proposed that her campus pay for the services she wanted from the Office of the President and that otherwise the campus be allowed to pretty much run itself. I don't want to make too much of this. It was a proposal. Nothing further came of it. The proposal was made because of a real problem the campus was experiencing, and I think that has been worked out. But, you know, if that's a straw in the wind, I think that it misunderstands the relationship or what the relationship has historically been between the Office of the President and the campuses, which is oversight and ensuring compliance with state policy, presidential policy, and regental policy to assure university accountability to the university and the state. I'm not saying that UCOP doesn't provide services. In fact, I've just listed some of them, but that simply isn't broad enough to encompass what it does. I think a deeper problem is the Office of the President is in an asymmetrical situation with respect to the campuses. Campuses criticize the Office of the President publicly. The Office of the President doesn't criticize campuses. This is probably just good politics on the part of the Office of the President. I don't know. But the fact is that there have been a number of reports very critical of the Office of the President in recent years, and the view that people get of the Office of the President, of what it's supposed to be doing, often comes through in reports that are devoted to criticizing it. I don't think this is a really healthy situation. Jack Pelteson used to joke about what he called the hierarchy of scapegoats. The departmental faculty member blames the department chair blames the dean blames the chancellor blames the president, but more likely it's the office of the president. This may just be the normal state of affairs for system offices, although it's interesting that often presidents, they act as if they don't know anything about the office of the president, right? Don't blame me. But in any event, I think the problem is that, first of all, it suggests, I think the university would benefit from a restoration of a spirit of trust between campuses and the office of the president, number one. Number two, I think, you know, the bigger problem is not just Office of the President Appreciation Day, but that this situation contributes to a kind of lopsided conversation within the university in which centralization is regarded as inherently suspect and decentralization is regarded as always good. I don't think that is true. Okay, I'm going to try to wrap this up. If I were to try to talk about the differences between the one university and what I've called the economic model, one would be that the one university idea is a federal structure, and it's aimed at, it recognizes the pressures and the tensions within the University of California system. It recognizes that sometimes campuses really oppose system moves, and sometimes campuses are against other campuses for one reason or another. But the idea is, because of this constant process of negotiation, among other things, to work out, to take some of the pressure out of these different tensions within the system. The economic model, you recall, its solutions go all the way towards getting rid of systems. One of the studies says that in order to survive these days, universities need to be entrepreneurial, and the only way really to be entrepreneurial is to be free of all system and state controls. Well, so it sees a system as a shell from which campuses need to break out. Since I'm a student of literature, maybe it's why I notice the language, but you see it in administrations are urged to be nimble, campuses need to be unleashed, and the whole idea is, let me out of here. So the problem is, a lot of economic model solutions are moves toward privatization, and that is a big problem for public universities. Whatever the source of funding, universities are regarded by the public as public. One example is differential tuition, charging more at the more selective universities. A group of chancellors and presidents back in 2011 discussed this possibility, and they came up with two responses. One was that if differential tuition were done, they were not ruling it out, but they said if it were done, it really needs to be done in a way that protects the aspirations and welfare of the smaller campuses. And secondly, they raised the question of whether a better idea wasn't to raise tuition system-wide. Obviously, that is a political hot potato, and in fact, one of my arguments about using economic models of governance is that some of these problems are not really problems of organization. They are political problems that are going to plague the university, whether every campus becomes independent or whether they're part of a system. But in any event, the public sees, however small, and currently I guess we get somewhere between 10 and 11% of our revenue from the state, it may make sense to us to say, well, if the state's going to cut our money, we should be able to cut away from bonds of the state. But the public sees us as belonging to them, and they have some good reasons for that. The state of California started the University of California. It is the money, support, and loyalty of the people of California that has enabled it to rise to its current position of eminence. And the Academic Senate has discussed What are the possibilities for, if we have longstanding programs that have been supported by the state, can we really privatize them? Is that something we can do? So we have even more problems than we realized, given the public-private divide. All right, a key question to conclude is disassembly, which is what I think with her emphasis on local control and getting rid of central controls, economic models represent, are they key to financial survival? One reason I'm skeptical about that proposition is that aside from, you know, getting rid of systems, most of the other proposals they make for saving the university's financial future really are things that could, I believe, could be done within a system. More fundraising, for example, a better return on overhead rates, raising tuition, more out-of-state students, although those last two, as we know from yesterday's news, are politically hot-button issues. But they're not really, I would argue, system issues. So I think we could, I think an argument is to be made that we can solve it within a system. Richard Atkinson, when he talked, former UC president, when he talked to the Commission on the Future some years ago, he said that we may need to follow the University of Virginia and the University of Michigan, both distinguished institutions that are becoming less public and more private all the time, as far as student fees and other revenue-enhancing measures are concerned, but they're not a model for UC in the broader sense. UC is a public multi-campus system, and we must deal with our problems and work out our destiny as a system. Well, I want to talk about three possible futures for the One University idea. It could continue as it is today, and I would characterize that as keeping the essential philosophy alive, but with more power going from the center, more authority going from the center to the campuses, and with a role for the Office of the President that seems to me is a little bit not as settled as it used to be. It could be displaced by one of the economic models. The regents could decide, the regents and the president could decide, that the financial problems of the university are so serious and this really is, the economic model is the answer, and it could go in that direction. I don't think so, at least not to the more extreme versions of it, but it's possible. Or it could gradually fall away, like the symbolic role of the president, and eventually become an artifact of another time. And if that's the case, then a lot of small changes will have made a very large change indeed. Finally, there's a historian, he's down at Stanford these days, who has talked about some of the results of economic models of thinking on American society, and he's talked about how something has happened to the way we look at large institutions in the late 20th century, and that the emphasis on choice, desire, and the individual as a unit of action has made it harder. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the things that has made it harder for people to really feel part of and identify with large institutions that span a number of communities. Obviously, multi-campus institutions are a good example of this. The University of California's One University idea has been built on a very different kind of thinking. And that thinking is that there is such a thing as a multi-campus system that really is One University of California. I think it has been a great help to the University of California in the past, and I think it's going to go on being that way. And so in spite of all the tensions, in spite of all the problems, in spite of all the heartburn, I really think the One University idea is worth all the trouble. So I'll end there. Thank you very much.
Questions, Pat?
I will certainly take questions, yes. Comments? Yes, sir.
Well, thank you for a wonderful discourse of the university. Two things come to mind. One, first, there was an additional recommendation in the 2011 chancellor's letter to the president that we put in, and that is give all the money that we get back to the state and put it into scholarship.
Right.
And it seems to me that's something that hasn't received enough thought, and what are the consequences of separating us out more from the state doing that. Then the second that raises for me, and you used the, this a bit in your closing remarks about this is not an academic issue or organizational issue, it's a political issue. And, you know, as an engineer, I would say let's design a system that has the greatest probability of success to thwart the political interventions that we have to live with in the state. And it seems to me putting the question that way might suggest a different way to look at the pros and cons of a system model.
I agree with you. I think that it's, well, first of all, the proposal to have the state put all its money into student scholarships has the example of focusing state attention on the fact that the public's money goes for students and makes some of the emphasis less on other things it goes that the public doesn't support. I simply have no idea how that would play as a possibility. My only reservation about the engineering approach is reminds me of something that David Gardner used to say. Remember his statement about the answer is not always the solution, or the solution is not always the answer. I think that the, like Chuck Young's proposal suggests negotiating contracts with the state, rolling five-year contracts. I think it's a similar sort of idea. And in exchange for getting, you know, negotiating a certain amount of money from the state, and you can work out what it's going to be for. Is it going to be for educating students? They wouldn't support basic research, but is it going to be raising the number of underrepresented minorities to a certain level by the end of the 5 years, whatever? Then the state would do that. But it wouldn't require us to follow state requirements on construction. It wouldn't require us to file all the reports we have to file with Sacramento right now. It just seems to me that the politics of this would be very difficult to do, and there, I would be a little concerned about the unintended consequences. But
yeah, well, no, the history of compacts with the state shows that that's not a good way to do things, because the governor and the legislature simply say we don't have the resources. So the compact is void.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I don't think you would want to be renegotiating contracts every 5 years. I mean, it just makes me tired thinking about it. But yes.
So ultimately, the structure and the culture is dependent upon the will of the citizenry and what they will support. Do you see anything as a potential movement to arise that would renew the sources of support that the university had historically?
That is an excellent question, and I don't know quite how to respond to it, because it seems that in California, the tax revolt back in 1978 created a mindset within the citizens of California that babies born since 1978 seem to have inherited, and which is so resolutely anti-tax. I think unless something can be done about that, it's going to be, you know, Proposition 13 is a great boulder in the way of the future of higher education in this state, and I think it's going to be very difficult. Temporarily, yes, but I take that as a hopeful sign. You never know.
This has to do with your last position on the screen. I've noticed in the very classy periodicals that I subscribe to that there's suddenly, I guess about 2 years ago, Riverside started putting in an ad. And I wondered if that made any fuss among the regents at the president's office, and did they have to get permission to do that? et cetera.
Well, I don't think they have to get permission to pick flowers either. That would be my guess. I don't know. You know, there are some things, when I first came to the office of the president, there were some things that we couldn't do and that campuses couldn't do. For example, when we had a question to ask at a campus, when I was a young staff person in the office of the president, we had to call the chancellor's office. We couldn't call anybody under the chancellor because that was considered you are violating protocol. Getting permission to use the official UC seal was a big deal. I think people go online now and they just, you know, they read the thing about you must get permission and they just take the UC seal. A lot of things have been, a lot of things have loosened up a lot. So I would not think that, I would be surprised.
Bothered anybody.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, Dick.
Yeah, very, very excellent presentation. Two things, but I'll just start with one, and that is simply what you didn't talk about was the if there were any differences due to the leadership style or frankly, the competency of who occupied the position as UC president, which is, of course...
Oh, the book I could write.
Yeah. I say it with certain seriousness because, in my view, in the last 10 years, there hasn't been thus far, and that might be changing, but a president that was very effective in dealing with these issues and in dealing with the campuses. And I think that it has to have an influence. Now, I suppose the other question you could ask, is there anybody, you know, or who? What would be the criteria for a president that would be successful? I don't know the answer to that either. But I guess the question is, how much does the... you know, individual president and their character and their ability to lead have to do with where we are today?
It has a great deal to do with it, and I'm not going to touch that further with a stick. But there is one thing I will say. I think one difference in the effectiveness of, let me put it as the office of the president, is there has been a change in attitude towards the office of the president. It has had... It's been on sort of a downward spiral in some respects, and a lot of it stems from the executive compensation controversy back in 2005, 2006. I wrote two papers on that. I spent months on it. I interviewed 35 people, and I came to the conclusion that, as many of you may recall, the narrative that the university put out was that the university not only had violated its own policies, but it had forgotten all about the changes made in a previous executive compensation scandal in 1992. And so it had it got two black eyes that it couldn't even, one, it had violated its own policies in 2005-06, and in 1992, it had forgotten all the lessons of 1992. When I looked into this, what I concluded was, odd as this may sound, the first executive compensation controversy was based on a real kind of short circuit in the Board of Regents about executive compensation, too complicated to get into. But that the second one was based on a misunderstanding of a document called Principles for Review of Executive Compensation, which was adopted in 1992 and supposedly was going to end it. We had a new president in 2003 who did hire some chancellors and gave them benefits that were outside university policy. He was obviously, well, I mean, I think he was proceeding on the idea of what is reasonable. And when that came to light, I think instead of drawing on institutional memory and recognizing that the regents in 1992 were not concerned about all benefits. They were only concerned about the benefits involved in the 1992 controversy. I trust this is obscure enough. But in any event, that there really hadn't been a massive violation. There had been a few violations of university compensation policy, but not massive ones, and there certainly hadn't been an amnesia about 1992. Here's what I'm getting at. What the region said at the time is that the executive compensation controversy, they felt, indicated a problem of governance in the office of the president. And that began a series of changes in the office of the president and what I think is a narrowing of the view of what the office of the president is doing, a harsher view of its performance in a way that has made it more difficult to work out some of the problems. So I'm sorry that was such a long-winded answer, but that's what I think.
Pat, do you think the relationship between the campuses and the president's office has gotten worse, or is it about the same? I mean, there's always been a lot of tension
right
there, but what's your view of
it's changed? My view is not based on direct observation. I haven't been in the office of the president for a long time. One thing I've heard as a possibility that is really more symbolic than anything else, but symbolic matters matter a lot, is that one of the budget changes was that, you know, the Office of the President used to be funded off the top of the state budget. It is now funded by an assessment on each of the campuses that is sometimes called a tax, sometimes not. But the bottom line is that although it makes no difference from a financial point of view how the Office of the President is funded, I think it makes a psychological difference. How much of a difference, I don't know. But I think it makes a psychological difference that the campuses are now in some sense paying for the Office of the President. And I think that may increase the sense of why aren't I getting the services I want from the office of the president if you're a campus? And I'm sympathetic to that. I get that. But that's all I can say about it. I don't know. You hear things, but I don't really know. Betty Lou.
So I just wanted to raise three subjects that didn't come up. One in terms of the contributions of the One University idea. I think it deserves attention. The role of policy making, policy development that the Office of President supplies in coordinating, negotiating, formulating, and actually implementing a whole set of research policies that contribute to the prestige of the University of California and the way it conducts research. It protects it from all kinds of industry interests, political interests, everything, because as one system, there's a set of policies about what a publication policy is, the patent policies, all of those things formulated as a unified university contributes a lot, and not just in research, but also in terms of graduation requirements, in terms of all sorts of academic policies that protect that quality aspect. So policymaking is, if it's 10 campuses making their own policies, it would affect the ability of them to protect it. And on the state and federal front, when policies come up that affect research, that affect the university in many, many ways, that one university system gives it more political strength.
That's very interesting. I had not thought of that.
The second thing I felt just worth mentioning is I would just be interested in your own experience about the changing leadership in the university being affected by the lack of experience of most of the leaders we've had in a long time at the campus level, the chancellor level, and the president level with the one university idea. They're just people who have no experience for what that might actually mean, and a more sort of management business school kind of any organization is the same, not seeing the unique qualities even of what a university is. And in that realm, I would ask you to reflect thirdly on the changing nature of the regents and the way that they too have been both in personnel leadership and in attitude, much more corporately oriented with very little sense of what does it mean to have a mission of education and the advancement of knowledge? For them, it's just another, you know, complex organization that should be run like a corporation and with the same economic exigencies, let alone, I don't think that the concept of a mission other is really central, but I'd love your response.
This seemed like such a good idea, this topic, when I started, and now I'm... let me make just a stab, and then perhaps we should stop because we do have some refreshments. I think it does make a difference that leaders within the university are coming from outside the university and are not familiar with the One University idea. I don't know how one deals with that because it certainly has been happening. And from the one thing I can say from my experience is that the University of California has a very complex culture, and it really does take, I mean, the faculty are so powerful in this organization. It is so large and so complex that I'll put it this way, you have a real advantage if you were a chancellor or a vice chancellor, which all the presidents I worked with except Charles Hitch were. Even then, it took about a year for a change in perspective to happen, and you could see it happening sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, but there really was a recognition that it is different at the university-wide level. But the One University idea was never a problem because, you know, you grow up with that if you are in the University of California. So maybe that would be one of the changes that gradually over time, if more and more leaders are not familiar, where change will come to the University of California. As far as the Board of Regents is concerned, I'm simply not well enough acquainted with the current Board of Regents to comment, but you have reminded me of one closing remark that Clark Kerr, in his memoir, which I think is two volumes, it's fascinating, I really recommend it if you're interested in UC and its history. When he talked about reform in the University of California, he said, "The area of the University of California that I think is probably the most ripe for reform," and this is about 15 years ago now, he said, "is the Board of Regents. Here's the problem." He didn't say how. Anyway, I'll close on that note. Thank you all very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.